Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, coming to you once again from Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, high atop the Highway 7 Ridge Line from TSPN. That's the Survival Podcast Network headquarters. Today is March the 14th, 2012. Dude, that means we are almost halfway through March. Do you realize that? We're almost halfway through March, and we are only, what, 7 days away? 7 days away from the first day of spring. Spring has sprung. Time has already sprung forward. I didn't mention that earlier, but if you didn't turn your clocks ahead by now, you know that you messed up. And I think it's interesting. I want to open with a quote that I read on my Facebook wall the day of daylight savings time. It was an old Indian who asked about why the government created daylight savings time. And his response to it was, only the government would believe that you can cut the top foot off a blanket cut the bottom foot off a blanket, sew it to the top of the blanket, and end up with a longer blanket. Thought that was interesting. Anyway, what do we have to talk about today? Again, today, episode 859 of the Survival Podcast. I have a guy on the line here, Jack Doty. Jack is a really cool guy, living off-grid, doing the stuff we talk about all the time, actually doing it, and that's always a great interview. I'll bring him on in just a moment. Before we do that, though, I want to help. I want to go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day number one today, Ready Made Resources. What more can you ask for from a company than they say, this is our name, and it's what we do, and then they do it. That's what Ready Made Resources does. All the stuff you need for your prepping, ready made and ready to go on their website, point, click, buy. Great prices, great service, lightning fast shipping. And guess what? When I say everything, I mean everything. Gardening, check. Tactical, check. Long-term storage, food, check. Photovoltaic, check. Wind, check. 12-volt products to work with them, check, check, and check. You get the idea. ReadyMadeResources.com. Check them out today. Next up today, BulkAmmo.com. Say it all the time. I don't know a better way to explain it, though. Your gun with no ammunition is a very expensive club. I guess it's a good barter tool, but it's not good as a gun without ammo. You gotta have ammo, and you gotta have enough of it, not just to get through lean times when ammo prices might go up or become unavailable, but so you can actually train with your gun and use your gun and be capable with your gun, or that's not really much use either. A gun and ammo, but no training doesn't work either, so we need ammo for all of those reasons. Best place to find the really common caliber stuff at a great price in bulk. BulkAmmo.com. Remember, both Ready Made Resources and Bulk Ammo do support the Member Support Brigade with special programs. Next up today, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Those are the ways to connect with me other than straight through the show. A lot of time I put stuff out on Facebook and Twitter in particular that does not make it on the show because of the volume of information that's passed my way. I can't get everything on the show. Last but not least, do consider joining the Member Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get exclusive content available only to members, like some videos you can't get anywhere else. You'll also get discounts to over 31 different supporting vendors, over $150 worth of free ebooks. As always, military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, active duty, or prior service. Email me before you join. Tell me who you are or what you did or who you are and what you're doing, and I will send you a special discount code to thank you for your service to our country. Now, as I said, we're going to talk to somebody that's actually doing the things and living the lifestyle that we talk about all the time. His name is Jack Doty. He has a website called ChristianHomesteaders.org. Jack lives with his wife, Mary Lou, and they've lived off the grid in a homestead in eastern Colorado for 13 years now. Electricity is created with a wind charger and photovoltaic panels. All water is captured on the roof and held in cisterns. Water is recycled with a gray water system. They use a sawdust toilet. Compost is used to build better soil. Intensive gardening methods are studied and developed for use around the world. And Jack actually provides homestead training for missionaries, homeschoolers, and homesteaders. It's a great story, and here to tell us more about it is Jack Doty. Jack, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Hey, I got a lot of questions for you because you are living a lifestyle a lot of people aspire to live someday or think they might have to live someday. And you've done a great job of, it sounds like, building a homestead. And in an area of the country that I often hear from people and say, oh, you can't garden in Colorado. And I think you're proving that's not the case. But you wanted to come on today and kind of talk about how the homestead can be a safe haven in an unstable economy. So would you say that you guys maybe have a lot less stress than the average American does today because of your lifestyle?
That's definitely true. We are in our 60s, and we're both semi-retired. Most of the work I do is right here on the homestead. And because of the way we've set ourselves up without utilities and without a lot of expenses, now when everyone is scrambling to keep a job or work two jobs, we're able to live with relative ease just with the work that we can do here. We do have money coming in from Social Security, which, as you know, is never very much. But
yeah.
In our case, it was a raise.
I got you.
So in almost every case on the homestead, most people will have to have some income that comes from outside, a job or, you know, money they've laid aside. Almost everybody needs a cash source to be on the homestead. To live completely off, you know, off the land is extremely difficult in America. You need some money for some things.
Agreed. That's why I'm pretty big on it. If you want to do it before you're in your 60s, build some sort of a small online business so that you can have that income. You probably don't need a tremendous amount. I mean, tell us about your electrical system. You do 100% of your electrical power with solar and wind, right?
That's correct. When we came out here, we've been on this homestead for 13 years. It was a clean slate. It was just a patch of dirt, literally. And so we started from zero, and it was going to cost $13,000 to set poles and bring in the wire from the electric company. And it was our desire not to do that, for one thing. And then when we saw the price, we said, well, that's a no-brainer. It cost us originally $6,500 to build the whole solar system and add a wind charger to it. Now, since then, we've added another couple of $1,000. We added a couple of more panels, solar panels, and just odds and ends. So we have somewhere around $8,000 to $8,500. And it's worked basically flawlessly for 13 years. The beauty of the new solar equipment is that it is so bulletproof and so tough and dependable that you're usually the only place around when the electricity goes down. You're the only place around that has lights. And that's been our case out here. And the only wire that we have coming from outside, we do have a high-speed internet cable from the telephone company that comes in. Other than that, we're completely off the grid. We collect our rainwater from our roof. Don't tell anybody. In the state of Colorado, you are not allowed to even collect a bucket full. But it's either that or we die, so we decided to collect the rainwater off our roof. We do not have a well. And that's has worked, again, pretty much flawlessly for 13 years. And we have been in the heart of a drought for the entire time that we've been here. It's been a terrible drought. And so we've been going with as little as 9 inches of rain. We're able to collect enough water to take care of all of our needs.
And does that include, like, you're growing food, too. So how do you manage to do that as far as, I mean, I can get, like, enough for the house, but how do you manage to water your crops?
Well, you know, we don't grow all of our food by any stretch. We would starve to death if we had to do that tomorrow, although we're working, you know, to add more all the time. The other part of our house is that we have a gray water system. So every drop of water that we get, we get about 1,000 gallons of water for every inch of rain. So in a very dry year, we get about 9,000 gallons of water. Now, every drop is used at least twice, so it becomes 18,000 gallons. And the way that works is all the water from the bathroom sinks and the shower and tub go into a gray water system that's used to water the trees and vegetation and garden. And all the sink, the other source is the kitchen sink, and that goes to another gray water pit, and that's used for the garden and so forth. You have to be very careful. The other thing we do in this climate, one of our biggest challenges is wind, high winds, and they just tear everything up, and they're terrible for the garden, and they happen to come in the early spring when you're just getting your plants going, so it's very tough. So we plant in SIP planters, sub-irrigated planters, and that just using the SIP planter, which is a container that you water from the bottom, in essence, and it also protects the plants from the wind. And by doing that, that saves about 70% of what would normally be spent on the garden right there.
Because you don't lose all that water to evaporation in the wind.
You don't lose it to evaporation, and the way it works, it just is a very much more efficient way of watering, and so our yields are tremendous, and we're using 70% less water for the garden.
That's awesome.
It really is, and you can get that information. There's all kinds of SIP planters, S-I-P, sub-irrigated planters, and if you go on the Internet and type in SIP and Google it, you will see all kinds of ideas for SIP planters, and they're just built out of junk, basically. We teach missionaries all over the world how to do this, so the technologies that we use here are all built very inexpensively. The people that we serve, a lot of them live on $300 a year, so they can't throw money at a problem. So we use a lot of junk. The house was built out of almost everything was used materials, used windows, used lumber. The walls are 5 feet thick. We used weed bales on three sides, great big 4x4x8 foot bales. That's why the walls ended up being 5 feet thick. But in this severe climate, this winter it got down to 35 below with the wind chill. And so having the extra insulation has really made all the difference. And it's a passive solar house, so we get about 75% of our heat from the sun. And that means we only cut 2 to 3 cords a year.
That's awesome. That's
yeah,
awesome.
And that makes, oh, what a difference that makes. You know, it's fun to cut wood, but it becomes kind of unfun when you're cutting the 20th cord and you're not through spring yet.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed splitting firewood for the first about a cord. And after that, you're tired and your traps hurt, and it doesn't seem, you know, you start out, you feel like this rugged mountain man splitting wood, you know, and a bit into it, you're like, man, this, I can see why people pay for hydraulic splitters, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it becomes too much work, and it's not efficient, and it's not a real good use of, you know, the bioenergy that we have. So we want to make it efficient, but at the same time, we want to be comfortable. We don't sit around here and, you know, with our teeth chattering. Another idea that we had is it was never the idea to rough it. The idea was to live well, but live simply at the same time and be able to actually afford living. And we've accomplished that pretty much with God's help. So it's, we're very happy with the house. The only problem that my wife has is that, you know, we are isolated. And that's a big problem for homesteaders everywhere. It tends to be, if you're going to do radical things like we've done with gray water systems and catching water on the roof and making your own electricity, zoning and codes get involved. And what it usually means is you end up living out in the sticks. And so that makes you isolated. And that's one of the challenges of homesteading, because she likes to go to town. She's from L.A., so this
oh, wow.
is a stretch at best.
Man, that's like Green Acres on steroids right there. Wow. Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Because you guys, I mean, even like, let's talk a little bit about the hygiene thing. You guys, like, one of the big expenses for people would be putting in something like a septic system or tying into a sewer grid. You guys use basically a sawdust toilet. How does
right.
that work out? I mean, it sounds good in theory, but, you know, there's apprehension most people, including myself, would have. Like, okay, well, that's if we have to, but does it actually work well?
You know, I had exactly the same apprehensions when the first time I heard about it and read Jenkins wrote a book called Humanure, and I read about it, and I thought, man, that's the worst idea I've ever heard.
Yeah.
But I was doing a project, a building project up in the mountains, and I was all by myself. And I thought, well, heck, here's a place to try it. And I was shocked at how well it worked. It doesn't have odors. The toilet is actually inside the house. It's comfortable. It's easy to use. It doesn't have to be just sawdust, but it's something like sawdust. It has the texture of confetti, and it's absorbent, and it's high in carbon. So it would be like rice hulls or ground-up peanut shells or dried leaves that were ground. And that absorbs the moisture, and it covers up the odors. And what it is, basically, is just a 5-gallon bucket in a comfortable seat. And then when the bucket is full, it goes out to the compost pile.
Hmm.
And there we let God do all the hard work. He turns it into the most beautiful compost you've ever seen. Now, you have to use extreme care if you're going to use this on your garden. A lot of people will just use that compost on their trees.
Sure.
And that's another option that is good. We do use it on the garden, but every bit of it has composted for at least a year. And that's the key. You have to let it take time. When you see incidences of people becoming ill with E. coli or salmonella or things like that, it's because the farm operation didn't take enough time. Almost every incident, when you track it all down, they used compost that hadn't properly cured and hadn't had enough time, or the farm workers were using the bathroom out in the fields.
Yeah.
And that's the case. So if
I've seen a lot lately with livestock where they say the problem is because they feed ruminants corn and grain now. That's another source of it with animal manure, even, because they don't produce the level of E. coli when they're grass fed. So I guess there's a lot of things that can cause that.
Yeah, and what we've done, you know, is learn how to do this, and it's real simple. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about this, and we do supplement the compost pile with animal manures because we need more nitrogen than we're able to supply, and so. But just about anything, you're going to be way better off if you're planning on using this for your garden or as a soil amendment. It's always great to run it through the compost pile. And if you're going to do that, you might as well learn to wait for a year on that compost pile. And then you're sure that it's going to be safe. And, you know, it's a foolproof method because that's the way things were designed from the beginning. Now, all of these things that I'm talking about, incidentally, are in my training manual that I use as I travel around the world teaching people about these ideas. And it's called Abundiculture, and it's on the internet, and it's free. So anybody can download it. It's a PDF file. And so you just go to christianhomesteaders.org. That's all one word, christianhomesteaders.org. And then you go to articles, and you'll see Abundiculture there, and you download it.
I did it in prep for the interview, and let me say it's a tremendous resource, and I think it's great that you give it out to people for free. It'd be worth $15-$20, no doubt.
Yeah, well, I certainly know how much it costs. It took me 8 years to write the original one, and this is the fourth edition. And it also, for those people who are believers, it has a Christian perspective, and that's kind of unusual. A lot of things that are written about living off the grid are written from a New Age kind of perspective, but we believe that God designed everything that we have in the world, and therefore his ideas of how to use it are the best. And so we have a kind of a unique perspective. Everybody's welcome to it, and they can see if it makes sense.
Very, very cool. I wanted to also ask you, like you had already kind of touched on this, but one of the questions I had set up to ask you here was, a lot of people say they want to live off the land. And so when people say that, I think there's varying degrees of that you could live off the land, but you probably need some outside source in just about any instance.
Absolutely. As I said, I researched this part of my job in training and so forth, is to keep up on the latest literature. So I'm always reading about homesteading and what's happening across the country and so forth. And as I said previously, almost every homesteader has somebody on that homestead is working outside of the homestead making cash. because cash is needed for things on the homestead. Cash is needed to pay the bill for the mortgage, for gasoline, all the things, and then for most people, food. As I, you know, we've been working, and we're edging toward growing more food all the time. But this is an extremely difficult place to grow food, and if we didn't have money coming in, we'd starve. So most people will find that to be true. And so you have to have some skills and talents. The people who do very well at this are people who have, I'm thinking of a neighbor who lives about a mile from me here, and he is an excellent welder and mechanic. And everybody for miles around uses his skills and is happy to pay for them. And so he can live, you know, comfortably and make money using what he does. I can make some money now. As I told you before, we do get a pension, you know, from Social Security, but I make some money because I use my homestead as a training center, and people actually come here and stay for several days and learn how to do all the different things that we're trying to do. So you're thinking, usually you're trying to think of, well, how do I make this homestead create some income? And, or a lot of people are perfectly happy to have a job in town. They like their job in town, but they also like to live out in the country, and it works out well for them that way.
You mentioned earlier, too, on being out in the country, kind of the isolationism. What are some of the steps you guys take to deal with that? I know that we actually live a lot less remote than you guys do. We have a small town, you know, 10 minutes away, really, and my wife struggles with it. So what are some things that you think people can do to deal with that a little better?
Yeah, I think this is a problem for the ladies more so than the guys. We tend to be real task-oriented, and so, you know, we kind of have our head down, and we're trying to get everything done that needs to be done.
Yeah, I'm too busy to be lonely, basically.
There you go. Exactly. But your wife, on the other hand, her domain typically will be doing a lot of things on the inside of the house. And if you have kids, you know, she's cooking and she's working. And that work can become, you know, really tough when you do it every single day and you don't have a diversion. The way that we handle is we do go into town. Usually we end up going twice a week. We go to church in town, but then usually we have to go one other time a week to pick up materials. We live 50 miles from the nearest Walmart, and we are really in the sticks. Now, we have wonderful neighbors here, but a lot of people will find that if you live in the country, one of the reasons that your neighbors moved out here is they do not like to be bugged all the time. And so a lot of times it's real hard for the ladies to find someone who can be a real good friend out in the country because, you know, less people, less opportunities. When my wife says she's an opera singer, and that was what she did in L.A., and so when she says, "Jack, we're going to the opera on Saturday," no matter if I really need to be doing something else, I say, "Yeah, we're going to the opera on Saturday." And, you know, as a guy, you really better be sensitive to this, or you're going to be homesteading by yourself.
Correct. Watch the Jennifer Aniston movie on the DVD player if that's what she wants to do. That's
exactly.
That's kind of my thing that I have to do is watch stuff like that once in a while. And I put the computer away even, and I just sit there and I just pretend I'm interested because – you know, I mean, that's just what you got to do sometimes as part of being a supportive husband.
Well, in this case, you got to realize, you know, that a lot of times we're all each other have out here because we are so isolated. And so you got to really be sensitive to that. Now, the other issue is that if we got an influx of money, I would be happy to buy her a condo in town. And then she can stay in town as much as she wants. And we can have this, you know, she can come out here as much as she wants. So if I could, that's what I would do. Because she gets pretty unhappy sometimes, but she's a real trooper and she hangs in there. And going back to the composting toilet, she is very cool with the composting toilet. And that is the biggest stumbling block in all the technologies that we use here. People just freak out. But it's never bothered her in the least. and she is not a hippie chick, never was and never will be. So it's different, but it certainly works for us. And so many places that I go in the world where they, part of the grinding poverty that you see in the third world is caused because the methods used there have destroyed the soil and destroyed the environment. All the trees are gone. If those people are going to be able to survive, they have to rebuild those soils. And the answer to that is composting toilets. They also have tremendous problems because they don't have clean water, so their infant mortality rates are very high, and the sickness that is caused by waterborne diseases is terrible. And so you're killing two birds with one stone. You're recreating, getting the soils to be stronger, and you're taking care of the human waste in a way that's very sanitary and very safe. And so it works very well as part of a strategy to rebuild a terrible environment.
Great. What would you think some of maybe the biggest mistakes that are made by people that are new homesteaders?
Overspending.
that's nothing that's, changes, huh?
Yeah, that's the first thing. They have very large ideas, and I appreciate that. I'm kind of a dreamer myself. But what I've learned as an old guy is that it's a whole lot easier to do things in small steps and not deal with debt than it is to get yourself into debt and then lose everything. And I've done it both ways. So the first thing, if you read all the literature like, you know, Countryside Magazine and Backwoods Home and Back Home and Mother Earth News, you read these stories of homesteaders and you see this pattern of folks who got themselves, they tried to do too much with too little capital and then got themselves in a big mess, and the stress and the frustration destroyed the homestead, or they just lost it. So start out real simple. And again, the training manual will be a big help because, again, we designed it to be able to do things with very little money. And so that's the first problem. And the other key one that I see consistently is the isolation. So you have to have people in your family on board. And if you have teenage kids, it can be the greatest thing in the world for teenage kids, or it can be an absolute disaster. And it depends on if they, you know, if they buy into it. If they hate it, well, if you've had teenagers, you know that can be, those can be long days. So if they like it, and a lot of kids do, because they find a real purpose there, what they can do on the homestead is very valuable to the whole family. And there's a great thing in feeling like, man, what I do here is important. And so if you can get your teenagers into that mode, then they'll love it. But it's not for everybody. So I guess those are the two biggest problems, is how do you manage your finances and how do you deal with everybody in the family, making sure that everybody's on board.
And that may be a real struggle for some and real easy for others.
Yeah, it requires, I always tell people, you know, take time to really think about this. Don't rush out. People get, you know, romantic idea of how great it would be to have a beautiful place in the country. And yeah, it is nice to have a place in the country, even if it's not all that beautiful. But they get excited and they go out and, you know, on a Sunday drive, and the next thing you know, they've got a 40-acre piece of property, and they just kind of lose sight of the practical things that have to be done. And if you're dealing with code, see, this really changes everything. When I came out this piece of property, I told you it was just a piece of dirt. Now, most people in that situation, they would have to put in a septic tank first if they were under code. I wasn't under code because they didn't have it out here at that time. So the first thing they'd have to do is they'd have to pay for a septic system. That could be $5,000 to $10,000. The next thing they'd have to do is put in a well. That could easily be $30,000. depends on how far you have to go. Where I live, we start at 400 feet, and then the next step is 800 feet, and the next step is 1,200 feet. That gets expensive. So you see, the real problems that you can get into, and then we haven't even talked about building a house yet, it's very easy to spend $250,000 on a very, you know, simple house and all the infrastructure that's needed, and it can be hard to make enough money to live out in the country.
Because the whole reason you're going is to get away from that entire lifestyle in the first place.
Well, that's why I came out. So it wouldn't have made any sense at all for me to, you know, to go ahead and do it just the same way. You know what the definition of insanity is. You do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. The problem that I often see is that people see the problems that urban living brings, and there are lots of problems that are involved there. For me, the main one is that lack of freedom, lack of being able to do what I want to do, having people, you know, right next to me that are breathing down my neck and worried about, you know, what I'm driving and what I'm wearing and how I'm acting. We have a saying out here, I don't want anybody so close that I can see them, hear them, or smell them. And that works out real nicely for me. So,
yeah.
If you want to, you know, get out into the country, then you live differently. We have different problems. A lot of people who have this romantic idea, they think, well, I'm going to go to the country, but it's just going to be like I'm living in the city, except that I won't have neighbors close. It's not. It has a lot of different challenges. For instance, you have lots of insects in the country. A lot of people right there, that would be a deal breaker.
Sure.
And you just do. When you're out in the country, not everybody's spraying for bugs, so you end up with more insects.
Correct.
Smells. If you have cattle close, you know, you might be dealing with odors or flies. So these are things that are part of living in the country, and if those things, you know, turn you off, then you need to think about those things, and you can't do it when you're starry-eyed.
Yeah, you know, and I think a lot of it's regional, too, about what's going to happen, because, like, I had a guy email me recently and said they wanted to move out into a more rural area, and they're living in southern Florida, but they live in a gated community now, and his wife is afraid there might be snakes. And I'm like, well, in your instance, that's not a concern, because if you're in southern Florida, a gated community is not a snake keep out. There's snakes all over southern Florida, but in other areas that might be a big concern. We have timber rattlers, copperheads, and things like that around on our property, and it's just something you have to be aware of and look out for. But you probably don't have to deal with much of that in Colorado. It's a different climate.
Well, we actually do have rattlers out here, but I've never seen one on my property. We also have cats, barn cats, and cats and rattlers don't get along.
Yeah.
And they tend to keep the snakes down. So I've been fortunate, you know, not to have a whole lot of rattlers around.
What I've done is every time I see a king snake or a milk snake is I catch it and I take it home. Because that's your number one defense. They eat rattlers, you know.
Yeah.
And
we have bull snakes. They look like a rattler, except they don't have the rattle.
Yep.
And we grab those guys and bring them here. And it works very well. You know, another thing is dealing with the weather. If you're in town, you're counting on the people to come and plow you out.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get snow out here or any inclement weather, it's our problem. And
sure.
Then you're off the grid, see. I can't call anybody to fix my place. I'm the utility company.
Sure.
So if there is a problem, then I'm the one who's going to fix it.
Absolutely. I mean, you even see it without going as far as you are. Where we're at, we're not far from town, but we are rural. We do have grid electricity, but when the power goes off, we're last. Because down in the town, there's 20,000 people without power. Up on our mountain, there's about 13. And it's not discriminatory. It's just priority. Who do you focus on first? And you focus on the greatest number of people first. So there might be power out downtown for a few hours, and we might be out for a day. It's very, very common for that to happen up our way. And we do have a well, unlike you guys, but if you don't have power, you don't have the well running. So a generator becomes critical.
You bet. Well, you know, those are kind of the negative aspects. Everything has a downside, and homesteading is no different. But I'd like to focus a little bit on the positive.
Absolutely.
Too. I can't think of a better place to raise kids.
Agreed.
They learn responsibility. They learn independence. They learn how to think. We call them farm kids out here. And the difference between the way a farm kid communicates to adults and the way a kid from the average kid from town communicates is night and day, because farm kids are working with adults all the time. They look you in the eye when they talk to you. They speak in an intelligent manner. They are capable of doing lots of things that are really appreciated. So from the standpoint of raising kids, I think it's a great place to raise kids. The other issue is you actually are there with them doing projects together, doing work together, and that's a great time to share with your kids, you know, what's important to you. And they learn by osmosis. This is what Dad thinks. This is what Mom thinks. This is why they work so hard. And so I think that's one of the great things. The other issue that I've struggled with all my life, you know, is making enough money to live in a modern city. That's not my idea. That's not why I work hard. I don't work hard because just because I like money. But if you live in town, it's a lot more expensive, or it can be, than living out in the country. And so that's another positive thing. I would rather spend my time, you know, in the garden than giving my boss another 2 or 3 hours. And so there's a much more direct line between the work that I do and the pleasure that I get from the work that I do than if I was in town. And I'm the kind of guy that likes to be outside a lot, and I'm the kind of guy that is not I like people a lot, but when I'm done with them, I'm done with them. And I want to be able to, you know, have some quiet and have some time for my own thoughts. And the countryside provides that.
Yeah, you and me both. I love people, but I also want to be able to say, hey, I got to go. And when I go, I don't want to go, like, across the street where you're still visible. I want to go away. Or I want them to go away. Either way works. But when you leave, I want it to be over.
Well, if you read some of the great writers about the agrarian life, like Wendell Berry, you know, he captures so beautifully, you know, the beauty of the things, the everyday things that we see, a meadowlark's song, the grass shoots coming up for the first time in the spring, in the fall, you know, the long days and the cool nights, all those things you really appreciate when you're out here. And those things I don't find in the city. So I think a person needs to think real carefully. The homestead life is a great life as far as I'm concerned, but it's not for everybody, and it needs to be well thought out with great care. And, of course, you know, there's so much literature out there, but using the Internet, I mean, this is the greatest tool. We have access to all the information that's available in the urban setting, but we don't have to go there and fight the traffic to get it. It's as close as the Internet. So that's a game changer for a lot of people. They really can have some of the best aspects of both worlds.
Yeah, it's amazing, really. Like, I remember when I was a little kid, before we moved back to Pennsylvania, and my dad worked 7 days a week, about 363 days a year. I think took 2 days a year off. I almost never saw him, and I was big into fishing, but without him around, I had to teach myself. And it was, you know, Field & Stream magazine was where you learn things like how to tie a knot.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn every single technique on any given skill set in a day if you really want to online today with information at your fingertips. And I don't know that people really appreciate in mass how incredible, especially the people that, like, grew up with it, like, that never had that experience. Like, when you wanted something, you ordered it from a catalog, or you had to wait for it, or you had to go through like 20 books to find one answer. And now the speed of the information return is just unbelievable.
It just opens so many doors for you. And a lot of people have an impression of people like ranchers and farmers that they're very simple people. That's the farthest thing from the truth. They have to know so many things, and they're some of the best users of the internet that I know. They're doing all their cattle sales, and they're taking care of their crops, and they're using the internet all the time to learn the things that they have to know to survive, and they have to know a ton. If you like learning new things, if you like a challenge every day and you don't like everything to be exactly the same every day, then homesteading's a great choice. I never get bored. Sometimes I'm terrified, but I'm never bored. So, you know, it's always a new thing to learn, a new thing to do, a new way to try to solve a problem. And that appeals to me. And if that appeals to the listener, homesteading might be a really great thing for them to do. And one of the things that we've kind of used is we provide training for that, because a lot of people have no clue where to start. And so there are a lot of training programs around the country, not as many as I wish there were, but you can go and spend a week or two and get a taste of it before you make a huge investment or a big life change. See what it's about. See if it really is what you want to do. And it helps to have somebody to kind of not get all romantic about it, just do the work and see what it's really like out there.
What exactly do you guys do for training? I know you work with missionaries, homeschoolers, and other homesteaders. Do you have people come stay at your place, or
right,
do you run workshops, or how do you do that?
Well, both. The best is if they can come to the homestead, because all the tools are here and all the chores are here. And we teach how to build simple solar systems, how to create water catchment systems, how to purify the water, food production, you know, how to work less and get more food, building techniques, particularly a lot of alternative kind of techniques, like building with tires, old tires filled with dirt, building with feed sacks full of dirt, building with mud and sticks. It's called wattle and daub. Just straw. Just get people. A lot of people don't have any experiences with using their hands. If they're a computer person, you know, they may have gone through their life without ever building a doghouse. Well, we can give them a little hands-on experience. And again, you want to find out, does that make you happy? Does it feel good to you to get out and, you know, and build something? We show them that and give them that experience. For the missionaries, a lot of times they're headed to places that are really tough. Just had a kid here last week that's on his way to Afghanistan, and he flies people around. He flies a little plane and takes supplies out and people and drops them off out on these little tiny landing strips. And he needed to know some of the skills for solar that he could share with those people. So I get a lot of missionaries, and then other homesteaders who have been doing it, and they just would like to have more ideas. And then homeschoolers tend to be doing a lot of the same things. A lot of times they're living in town, but they may have a big garden, and they're wanting to catch some rainwater for the garden and things like that. So those groups are the ones I focus on.
And I guess, you know, with homesteading, there really is all levels. There's people that are completely off-grid like you, way out in remote areas. There's people that are doing this kind of in a suburban area. I agree with you. It's harder because there's somebody looking and asking why you're doing what you're doing. And then there's people like me that are kind of in between those two worlds, where I'm out in the sticks, but yet I'm not far away. And I think that's something else people need to look at, is like, just because you want to do this doesn't mean you have to go all the way to one extreme or the other. It just, the closer you get, I think, to civilization, the more the ultimate cost ends up being financially.
I think that can be true. I have some friends that actually live in the city. Colorado Springs is the city closest to me. And it's a town, you know, with the outskirts included, of 500,000. So it's a big town, big city. You have to be kind of clever, but they are homesteading. They're making their own electricity. The problem is almost everything they do is illegal.
Correct. And that's what I mean. Like, to do it compliantly is, because the government's here to help us, right? And they always tell us, like, they want you to be more green and more energy conservation and better for the planet and all this. You know, we need these taxes for this and all. And then someone tries to live – if somebody tries to live the way that you do right now, let's say in Atlanta, Georgia, it ain't going to happen. There's almost no way they could possibly do it because – or they have to do it almost, like you say, on the sly.
Yeah, that's very disturbing to me. You know, part of our Christian beliefs say that, you know, we do try to obey the laws of the land and we try to, you know, be reasonable people. So one of the things that I'm always looking for are Christian lawyers who would like to tackle some of these laws and say, hey, let's create some zones. Let's create some areas where we're not under the standard code, where people can build what they want to and they can experiment with these things. The inflexibility of the code is the thing that makes it so hideous. And unfortunately, what the government's doing is they're trying now, a lot of people are seriously talking about one code that would cover, you know, from Nome, Alaska to Biloxi, Mississippi. Well, that's nuts.
That's completely nuts. There's totally different requirements, needs, environments, living conditions, and it's a huge threat to liberty because, and I'm sure you feel this way, I've moved where I've moved so I can live the way that I choose. And I've tried to get out of everybody else's way. You know, that's the big thing. Like, okay, I can't do this in the middle of town. Fine, I'll get out of your way, now leave me alone. And they're making that even difficult now.
Yes. You know, there's a new law that Congress is trying to get passed. Once again, they've tried this just recently, and they finally were beaten down, but they're back, and that is that you would have to register every chicken, every goat.
Oh, nays.
Yeah, well, now, that's gone.
Okay,
but
the new version of it.
There's a new version, and, you know, they just keep coming after you. Let me share something with you that comes from my experience of traveling around to third world countries. The difference between America and a third world country, there are several key differences, but the first one that is always the most frustrating is the corruption in the government. Now, we're gaining on them. We're getting more corruption all the time, but hold on just a second. Oh. We're getting, you know, more and more corruption in our own government, and with that, you very quickly can lose your rights to land. The other issue is that in most of the countries I go to, they've long since, they've never had guns. So they have no way to protect themselves. The Second Amendment is absolutely critical. I didn't feel so strongly about it until I went to other countries and saw what it was like when the people, when they were abused by the government, had no way to rise up. There's nothing they can do. And so if we allow our government to continue on its present course where they can use eminent domain to take our property and so forth, then we will be right in the same boat with all these banana republics. And why would I work so hard as I've worked on this property if I knew the government could just come in and take it? And that's what happens on a daily basis there. If a person has good success and they have a beautiful place, the government just comes in and steals it from them, throws them out, and there you are. So, you know, we have to be really vigilant, and we have to know that the corruption in our own government is not something that's out there. It's right next door, and we have got to do what we can to stop that, or we won't be able to have, you know, the blessings that we've had in this country for so long. A lot of that blessing is as a result of being able to own property and have the benefits of that property.
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying that since I started the show, that the biggest thing that brought early people here to America was the ability to own land and have the right to that ownership respected. Because especially when we go back to 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, there were a lot of places in the world where unless you had a birthright as a nobleman, it wasn't even feasible that you ever could own land. It simply wasn't in the cards for you. But you could come here and you could lay claim to 40 acres or 80 acres and it could be yours and you could have that. And one of my big concerns for our liberty is that gets more eroded every day.
And the big reason I push people to go do it is the more people doing something, the harder it is to take away. So people say, well, how do I defend the Second Amendment? You know, should I join the NRA? Should I get involved? And that's all great stuff. But the biggest way you can do it is own a gun, get training, be a safe gun owner. And if your state allows concealed carry, get your carry permit. Do the things that make you a member of that group of people. And the larger that group is, the harder it is for that group to be put down. And I think that we need to do that in all our walks of life. It's more about what we do than what we say or who we write a check to.
You're right. And trust me, the government knows how many guns there are out there. It's the only reason that they just don't, you know, steamroll us at this point. Excuse me. So, you know, they're aware that there are 350 million guns and growing all the time. And that puts pause. And that's why we have the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment was not, you know, so that we could go hunting. The Second Amendment was always about standing against a government that was out of control. And so we've got to have that. It's very important to the whole idea, because the land is everything. The land, you go back to the land for all wealth in one way or another. So if we can't own land, or if we can't keep the benefits of that land, let me take this in a slightly different direction. There was a story in one of the homesteading magazines here about a year ago. A gentleman had purchased a ratty old piece of land in upper New York. There's a lot of homesteading up there, a lot of beautiful land. He purchased this, you know, pretty sorry piece of land, worked for 23 years on it, developed it, built his buildings, turned it into a very beautiful place. He went from paying about $300 a year in taxes to over $10,000 a year in taxes. And as he got older, he can't afford to pay $10,000 a year in taxes, so he had to give up his homestead. It's this tax structure, and now let me define that a little bit. I consider a tax anything the government requests of me that they can use a gun to take. So it includes all regulations, all these things that they say are taxes.
That's a great definition.
If they can use a gun and they can use the force of law to come after me and take it, that is a tax. And so we have to be really cautious about that creep that comes along, and it just keeps little by little by little. Like the gentleman in New York, you know, he starts out at $300 a year, and he's suddenly up to $10,000 a year. You can't have that. That's you really have lost your ownership of your property in that situation when they can tax it right out from under you.
I remember a story I covered very early on in the show's history where it was Vermont put in a view tax. So if your property had a nice view, they automatically upped your property taxes because of the view. And the one guy, they were upping his taxes. He had this little shack, and he lived on this place. And it was a dramatically beautiful view, but it was a ridiculous amount of money they wanted from him. And it turned out the guy was blind.
Oh,
and
man.
That was the most absurd taxation story I've ever heard in my life to this day.
That is crazy. But, you know, that's what we're dealing with. From a Christian perspective, you know, we believe that God is in control. But we also believe that, you know, men are basically corrupt, and they will continue to be so, and that they'll do everything that they can to get what you have. And that's, unfortunately, that's reality. And so we have to be constantly vigilant. And again, I think it's easier to be vigilant when I'm out here minding my own business on my own piece of property. I'm very much aware when somebody sneaks, you know, yet another regulation that costs me money in. It's a lot more difficult in an urban setting because, man, you're taxed every which way.
You don't even know you're being taxed.
No,
when you're being taxed.
It's very hard to even be aware of it. So we have a little bit more control of it out here, but it's a constant battle. There's a wonderful book for your readers called, Heart of Dryness. It's kind of an odd title, The Heart of Dryness. And what it's about it's a little African or Aborigine tribe of bush people, and the government of this African country wants them to act like the rest of the people. They want to provide utilities and water, and these people live out in the desert, and they always have for 10,000 years, and live very simply and somehow survive out there and are very happy. But the government was embarrassed by them. And the whole book is about the struggle between this little tribe of people and the government, and the government eventually just crushed them, and they couldn't live out, you know, in the wild like they had for the last several millennia. And so what happens is that this is the standard operating procedure for all governments. Freedom has to be scrapped for and scratched for and hung on tight to, and you're always going to be fighting that fight. It never goes away. You never rest easy if you want to hang on to your freedom, because someone's always going to figure out a way to take it from you. Now, that sounds harsh, but as an old guy, I finally realized, hey, that's the truth. We can never stop working and stop fighting to hold on to our freedom. There will always be another battle down the road. And you must accept that and then go from there.
Completely agree. It's why I get on the radio and do what I do every single day. It's about fighting for liberty. It's precious, and we need to fight to keep it. Wise words, Jack. You want to tell folks again how they can find out more about the training you guys do, your homestead, your manual that they can download, where they can find that?
Sure. They can just go to my website, which is christianhomesteaders.org. It's all small case, one word, and then they open up that website and they can go to articles. They can download the book, Abundiculture. We believe that God really wants people to enjoy abundance. That's not driving a new Ferrari, but that means that you have enough to eat, you have clean water to drink, and you can enjoy the sunshine. And so they can go there. It's all free. It's all there. And all the contact information to reach me is there, and information about our classes and our training is there. So they can take a look at that. It's pretty brief, and they'll get all the ideas that they need.
Well, hey, Jack, again, I appreciate you coming on the show, and I want to thank you for fighting for liberty by living an example of what a liberty-filled life is like. Once again, really appreciate you coming on the show today. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico today, along with Jack Doty, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I could do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
revolution is you.